Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Tuesday, July 19th, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. I got Matt Norlander with me, and we wanted to knock out an episode before we both head to Las Vegas for the final five-day evaluation period of July. Norlander, you ready for Las Vegas?
I'm never ready for Las Vegas, to be honest, but yet at the same time, I'm ready. Should be interesting. You know, we'll get to see players we saw in Augusta, but then we'll see plenty of guys that we did not see, and it is always listeners don't want to hear it, but it like can truly be a grind in Vegas, because don't get me wrong, like, we'll have a nice dinner or two, and it's fun, especially to see everyone, but the mornings come fast, and the games go late. Like, we'll go to games, and they'll still be playing at 9 o'clock at night, you know, like, they just keep going and going and going, so it's definitely a grind, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm actually also, I won't spoil the story here, but I'm working on an Olympics-related story while I'm out there as well, so I'll dip out for a couple hours and work on that, and there'll be a feature on that on the site probably in the next 2 weeks or so.
It is. There's four major summer basketball events that'll be happening in Vegas at the same time. They basically start on Wednesday. You and I are flying to Vegas on Wednesday. Here's the important question. I have a 6 a.m. flight on Saturday because I got to be back home Saturday afternoon because I have to host a charity event on Saturday night. The odds that I make my 6 a.m. flight on Saturday, good or bad? Would you bet on me or against me?
I'd say 8 to 3 odds. That's what I'm laying right now. You've done this before. I feel like
I've never successfully done it.
I feel like twice in the past few years you've had like a 6 a.m. 7 a.m. flight. One time you definitely did not make it. I feel like last year you had this as well and you made it, but I might not be remembering that correctly. You definitely did not make it 1 year, without a doubt.
I think 2 years ago was I had like a 7 a.m. flight, and I had sometimes when you have an early flight, you'll wake up and you go, oh my God, I'm going to have to rush to get there. And I probably won't make it even if I rush, but like, I got a shot. Like, this was one of those deals where flight leaves at 7:05 and my eyes don't even open for the first time till like 9:15. Like, there's no shot. Like, the plane's already like in the air 20,000 feet before my eyes even open. So then I think last year I just sort of decided, like, no sense in lying to yourself anymore. You're not going to make that flight. So I booked a late afternoon flight. Like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. If you miss that one, you're just an idiot. I'm not saying it's impossible, but like it's much easier to catch that one than the early one. But this year, I've got to be home. I've got no choice. So I've got a plan. You're probably going to have to assist me with this. I'm taking my bags, rental car, everything to the airport on Friday night, like around 7, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, whenever we get out of the gyms on Friday night, taking everything I have and checking it at the airport, turning my rental car in. That way, no matter where we're at say 4 a.m., all I got to do is jump in an Uber and go straight to the airport and get on a plane and collapse.
That's a sound plan, but I'm going to be honest here. You had this plan. You've told me this plan before.
I feel like I've had this plan before, also poorly executed it.
And you definitely did not go – you definitely had this plan before, and you definitely did not go to the airport and do this. Now, it's a sound plan, and you can do it in Vegas because the airport is – like in some spots – like, you land the airport's 10, 15, 20 minutes away. Vegas, it's 5 minutes from the strip. So it's definitely very, very doable. And I'm all for you giving this a go. I do have skepticism that it's actually going to be pulled off. But I'm definitely willing to assist in whatever way I possibly can. But I know you've had this plan before.
Yeah.
Maybe you're right. Maybe last year you left afternoon. But I'm telling you, I feel like it was last year before you wanted to do this and you did not do it.
Okay. Well, listen, I will give an honest evaluation of myself on a podcast next week. I'll let you know whether I made the 6 a.m. flight or not. But certainly the odds are stacked against me. It's going to take something just short of a miracle to make this happen. Couple things that are interesting happening in college basketball over the past week. I want to start with some news that broke yesterday. Changes to the NCAA tournament. You wrote about it. The story's posted CBSSports.com. For people who haven't seen it yet, what changes are coming for the NCAA tournament?
Okay, so this isn't – all right, so the headline that actually this got somewhat decent amount of attention, more than I expected, was going forward – let's say we get to mid-February, okay? And the NCAA will be communicating with any possible realistic team that will be in contention for number one overall seed for the tournament coming up, you know, Selection Sunday, a few weeks after that. So realistically, this will probably be as many as 20 to 25 programs because the NCAA will absolutely want to cover all of its bases and make sure that anyone, you know, within possible logistical realm could be a number one seed. They'll communicate. And that program, that school, everyone will say, okay, we have these cities. In fact, I'll read you the cities real quick here. Next year, here's the first weekend sites: Buffalo, Milwaukee, Orlando, Salt Lake City, Indianapolis, Greensboro, North Carolina, Tulsa, and Sacramento. Those are the eight cities that will host first weekend games next year. And so the team that wins the number one overall seed will have the option of, they will get to say, okay, we want to travel here. Ultimately, this isn't going to change too much because what happens is obviously teams that are seeded 1 through 4 get geographic preference, but occasionally there are situations where a team is somewhat equidistant between two and it might choose one over another, but the committee might give it the one that it would not have chosen. Now the number one overall seed will get the choice. It's a cool little wrinkle. That's the definite thing that's coming.
Well, what you just said was my initial thought. Like, doesn't the number one overall seed usually go where it would want to go?
Normally, yes, but this, you know, at least it's something. Okay,
sure.
It's tiny. To me, the more important things are the things that are not yet set in stone, but that are moving toward, I think, being put toward into legislation for the season after the upcoming one. And that is primarily this ad hoc coaches committee that was from the NABC that was created this year. It basically got together. It's got a bunch of coaches on it. It's got Huggins and Few and a whole bunch of coaches. I think Calipari is actually on the ad hoc committee as well.
Yes.
And it sent a bunch of recommendations to the NCAA and its selection committee and said, hey, listen, you know, we want you to take these things into consideration. And one of the things was more emphasis on road wins and neutral wins. I had a really good conversation actually after Gonzaga was beaten Chicago with Mark Few about this. We talked for about 30 minutes about all this. Few is one of the best schedulers. He like totally gets it. But it basically wants the selection committee even more so to put emphasis on road and neutral wins, quality wins, really looking at strength of non-conference schedules when it comes to this kind of stuff. And there are plenty of coaches on this ad hoc committee who aren't at, you know, top 10, top 15 programs. So that's something that won't necessarily be written and explicitly followed for this upcoming season, but it could and should be something, and I think it will be something that gets put into effect going forward beyond that. And another thing, this is also a big one in my opinion, the NCAA is moving closer to having a composite ranking system that would include everything from KenPom to Sagarin. You know, it could have ESPN's BPI, which has plenty of critics, but I think it will include 5 to 6 mainstream rankings. I wouldn't put RPI in there, but it probably will end up being in there, and that's fine. Ultimately, what we will get is a composite. It will be an average of all of these different ranking systems, a 1 to 351, and it will be more of an accurate guide map for the selection committee. This is not official yet. It would not be in place for the upcoming season. The NCAA says at the earliest it would be for the season after, for 2017-2018. That's fine. I think we're headed that way anyway, and we should be. So these are pretty positive steps forward. And again, to the NCAA's credit, I say this every March, even though we kill the NCAA selection committee for a number of things, sometimes rightfully so, with Monmouth not getting in, with Tulsa getting in and all that stuff. They do genuinely try every year to at least get it better and a little more transparent. I think they're still moving that direction. So these are good things because ultimately everyone only cares about the bracket, you know, as we get to February and bubble teams win when Selection Sunday and the tournament and all that. But these are when these decisions are getting made, is in the offseason when no one's really thinking a lot about college basketball and the tournament and how the bracket's assembled. But this is when we're having these huge meetings and getting together and deciding how protocols are going to be put into place. So I think that's pretty important going forward. The number one seed was the main headline, but it's not much of a thing. Ultimately, I think there are other things that could still be done to improve both selection And that could, you know, increase the amount of intrigue with the bracket reveal overall. But I think those things are still to come. But I would qualify it as good news. But we still you know need some more time, and I think a year from now we'll be in a better spot overall.
I'm down with the composite ranking because I think any of the individual rankings are they're flawed in some way. But like you, getting a good solid composite out of 5, 6, 8, I don't care how many different computer formulas, like it's got to be an improvement over the current system. It won't be perfect, but anything that's better than what we have is better than what we have. So I'm down with that. Question for you on the number one seed thing. I think you and I agree the number one overall seed typically is going to go where it would prefer to go no matter what anyway. So so not that big of a deal. I wonder if there would be any strategy in this regard. Could somebody pick a Friday, Sunday, number one overall seed, and put geography aside and say, hey, we want to go to a Friday, Sunday pod because we want the extra day of rest, or we want to go to a Thursday, Saturday pod because we want to be back home on Saturday night or Sunday to have, you know, so we're not traveling on Sunday night or Monday. I wonder if that comes into play at all.
I think that's a very good point because, and it could also be totally valid.
Like what if you got what if you got a point guard with a bad hamstring or a bad ankle and you say, hey, like Ty, remember when Ty Lawson like had a toe problem or something? Let's say this upcoming year, I don't know, Monte Morris had a bad ankle injury or something happened in the Big 12 tournament, and you're Steve Prom, and somehow you're the number one overall seed. And you say, hey, let's just play Friday, Sunday because it'll give our point guard an extra day of rest. Like, I wonder if that will ever come into play.
I wonder if it will, and I also want to know, this hasn't been made clear yet, when the deadline would be, because what will happen is eventually the committee is going to need to know. To me, there's no reason why. Listen, the teams didn't know, period, before this. So right. To me, there's no reason why, let's say, the presumptive number one overall seed, these schools can't get in their word by midnight the night before the bracket reveal. There's no reason why they can't do that. So I think that should.
Yeah, why couldn't you just say, hey, we would prefer to go, if we're the number one overall seed, you know, we're a week out. Hey, NCAA calls. You might be a number one overall seed. Where would you like to go? We'd like to go to Indianapolis. What would be the big issue with calling on Sunday morning and saying, hey, we want to change. We'd rather go to Buffalo now. Like what? Like it wouldn't. It should. In theory, shouldn't be a big deal.
It shouldn't be. I do like this element of teams. I wish there was a little bit more. I've actually got a column idea. I don't want to spoil it on the podcast, and I'm thinking if I should wait until we actually get into the season. But I like – the only way I can tease this, I like putting more of teams having some sort of say, top teams of where they might play, who they might play against. I think that that adds a really interesting level of intrigue to the process. And I think if it doesn't mess up competitive balance within the bracket, it's something that the NCAA should absolutely look at further going forward, because ultimately Selection Sunday is just one of the most looked forward to sports television shows of the year, and the NCAA should be open to making it as good as possible.
Some recruiting news happened since we recorded our last podcast. Big significant recruiting news, unsurprising but still significant. Michael Porter Jr. committed to Washington. I know you had talked to Michael and at Peach Jam, and you know, he had insisted. All
I gave
along.
Him every possible
right.
Listen, it was basically presumed this was going to happen. I gave this kid every possible opportunity to not give other schools hope necessarily. He was insistent.
Right.
So I wrote it. You're going to tell me those things, I'm going to write it. You know, that you reached out to Indiana and Virginia and all these schools and wanted them to keep recruiting you. Ultimately, I'll let you finish your thought here, GP, but I come away with thinking this, like, you know, you knew at Peach Jam you were going to Washington. It was essentially a done deal. I don't know why you had to necessarily continue to string these schools along for another week or two, but it is what it is. He's a good kid. He's a great player. Washington's great to have him. Of course, they hired his dad. His brother's actually going to play there as well.
Right.
So it's a coup for Washington, and it's a major 5-star off the board in, you know, the summer. We often, you know,
we don't get these five stars going until August, September, October, November, even later. So yeah, we get an early one off.
I think it's smart for the kid just to go ahead and end this. Everybody knew where it was going. Like, I'm not interested in calling him a liar. You know, I don't think he was lying necessarily. Plus, he's a kid. I'm not going to be the old man calling a kid a liar. But, like, nobody believed him. I'll put it that way. Like, he was insisting my enrollment isn't tied to my father's employment. Nobody believed that. But I had talked to some of the staffs who were still recruiting him, you know, in addition to the Washington staff, and they were like, hey, listen, he's telling us that it's not over. He's telling us to that we're still involved. And so I took this to another assistant coach, and I was just sort of retelling that story. And this assistant coach said, the kid's just being polite. He's not like, you know, that's what he's being. He's being polite, but he's not going anywhere other than Washington. Like, this is crazy. And of course, then on Friday, he, before leaving for South America, is that where they went for the U18?
Yeah,
FIBA Americas tournament. He announced that he is committed to Washington. For people who don't follow recruiting or don't know this story, his father is Michael Porter Sr., and his father was hired by Lorenzo Romar, Washington's coach, back in May. So I wrote about this on Friday night. It's just amazing to me. And we've seen a lot of this in college athletics over the past week. How fans can be blinded, like fans resist the truth sometimes, even when the truth isn't bad. Like in this case, the truth isn't even bad. Like it's perfectly legal. If I were Lorenzo Romar and you told me, hey, you can get Michael Porter Jr. if you hire Michael Porter Sr., I'd say, cool. I'd hire his mom to get him. Like, whatever. The kid's spectacular. So, like, it's legal and it's something I would do. It's something other schools have done in the past. John Calipari's done it before. Josh Pastner did it at Memphis a few years ago. It's not unique to Lorenzo. It's not unique to Washington. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. And yet I still had, when I wrote the story, some Washington fans like just resisting the idea that this was tied to Michael Porter Sr.'s employment, resisting the idea that Lorenzo hired Michael only hired Michael Sr. to get Michael Jr., or that Michael Jr. went to Washington only because that's where his father went. And it's just like bananas to me. I don't understand why it's so hard to just acknowledge it is what it is. I had like Washington fans trying to explain to me on Twitter, well, GP, what you have to understand is Lorenzo's known Michael Sr. forever. Okay, cool. Well, he's also been a college basketball coach forever. Why didn't he try to hire him 5 years ago? Why didn't he try to hire him 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 7 years ago? Like, why did it just now happen? Because his son's just now of age to commit to and sign with a university. That's why. Why pretending otherwise is silly. Then I had people say, what was the other one? Oh, you have to understand Michael Sr. is a college basketball, as if I don't know his history. He is a college basketball coach. Okay, cool. And please correct me if I'm wrong, Norlander. Can you remember a time when a women's assistant coach was hired at a Power Five school as an assistant coach on the men's side? Like, has it happened in the history of college basketball?
I cannot specifically recall. I think there's a possibility.
I mean, maybe it has, but I can't recall.
A male assistant at a women's program has gone from one side to the other. I'm sure it's happened.
I guess it's happened.
Power Five level. I mean, it could have happened, but it's not. It's not something you see every day. I mean, listen.
You and I don't recall it. Okay, like, please. I mean this sincerely. If somebody knows an example, tweet us. I can't think of one off the top of my head. So you're really insisting that the first time, far as any of us know, that a women's assistant coach has got hired on a men's staff in a Power Five league, this is the first time, and it just happened to be on its own merits. It wasn't because his son is one of the top five players in America. Like, why would you even try to pretend that? I don't even think Lorenzo would try to pretend that. So, like, it is what it is, and it's fine. And yet, I had fan after fan, you know, with some sort of Washington avatar, try to explain to me how this wasn't a package deal. Like, somehow this was different than Memphis hiring Keelan Lawson or John Calipari before Josh Pastner hiring Milt Wagner. Like, it is what it is. It's fine. I just don't know what brings fans to what makes it so difficult for them to just sort of acknowledge it is what it is and move on? Why, like, I don't understand, like, this is the argument you want to get into because it's not an argument you can win. Like, no, everybody else sees it for what it is.
Yeah, that's a little bizarre. I don't know. The other interesting thing is that Romar is Porter Jr.'s godfather. I want to know, I'm sure it happened when he was like, here's the crazy thing. I'm sure it happened.
He became his godfather like 4 months ago.
I hope.
I'm kidding. No, that's not true.
Turned 14 or whatever. It would be amazing if that was the case. But they have known each other since the mid-80s.
Yes.
So there is like the relationship is based in some sort of like, you know, genuine connection there. So it is different from, you know, some things that have happened in other instances where assistants have been brought on and passed her and all that stuff. So
I agree, but it still is what it is.
It very much is what it is. And I mean, Washington is going to, I did not think Romar would make it through this past season, I'll be honest, but he did. And now he will have Markelle Fultz on the roster next season, who was a prospect a lot of people think can go top five in a very, very strong 2017 draft.
Right.
And then I'll have Porter after that. So if nothing, I mean, barring the most cataclysmic of seasons next year, Romar has a job for at least two more years and probably will extend that beyond that to the point where Washington should make the tournament both years, at least one, okay? And with that, he'll wind up being one of the longest tenured coaches at all Power Five schools by the time we get this, because I think he'll now, he's an alum of the school. I think he'll make it to at least 2020. He'll have gone two decades there. So this has really been a huge coup for him personally. We'll see what happens with the program overall. They're going to be interesting at the very least. And, you know, it's not – Washington's had, a few pros, come out of the system under Romar. We know that, Brandon Roy being the best of them. But it's not often that you see a school like Washington land these lottery talents so frequently. And so their lack of success has been more surprising than anything, given all of that. And now it should change because Porter should be the best of them all. But we'll see.
He's created an interesting dilemma for the school because he hasn't been to the NCAA tournament since 2011, I think.
Yeah, been a long time.
So he's missed 2012, 13, 14, 15, and 16. When you are at a Power Five school that's not Northwestern and you miss the NCAA tournament five straight years, like you don't usually survive that. Go do the research on it. You Power Five coach misses NCAA tournament five straight years. How many of them survive it? It's not a good number.
It doesn't happen often. It does, because we were talking about this, I think, last year, and it happens, but it's not common. It's six is like the drop dead, no shot. Occasionally you'll have a coach that'll last five, we'll get there sixth year, might hang on for a little bit longer. But I mean, Washington, I don't think they'll miss the tournament next year, but we could seriously have what I would have to think in the modern era, and I would qualify that basically since 1990, okay, since the paradigm of coaching major college athletics has changed. I don't think we have had one coach not at Northwestern go more than six straight years,
right,
not making a tournament, hold on to his job. It would happen at Washington because I just don't. They would literally have like six games for him to be fired.
Well, that's the dilemma, right? Okay, so like let's say they do miss the NCAA tournament and it's six straight years. Again, it is almost unheard of to at a Power Five school, particularly a Power Five school that like fancies itself as a quality basketball program, which Washington has historic, there's some history there. Like they've been good. They've been relevant at times. To go six straight years missing the NCAA tournament and get another year is almost unheard of. And yet, you don't fire a coach if he's got Michael Porter Jr. coming in. Like it's almost a career. It's almost like a contract extension. Like you hire Michael Porter Sr. to get Michael Porter Jr. and by extension give yourself what amounts to a contract extension. Because almost whatever happens this season, I can't see Washington firing Lorenzo Romar when he's got Michael Porter Jr. getting ready to enroll. Can you?
telling you, it would just have to be brutally bad. I just don't see how it's going to happen. So,
it's a smart investment. Like,
it is. No, it absolutely is.
It's smart from a basketball perspective. It's smart from a money perspective. And again, I got no issue. I've never had an issue with this. I was on a radio station in Seattle several weeks ago, and they asked me, because apparently this was a debate, you know, in that market, like, is this okay? Is this really what we want to be as a basketball program? And I was like, listen, if Michael Porter Sr. wanted a job, and you didn't hire him, somebody else could hire him. Like, if he made it known he wanted a job, I know that never came. I talked to some other staff that were recruiting, and they told me it never came up in conversations. Like, when Michael Sr. took the job at Washington, it wasn't something that he had talked about with, say, Virginia or Indiana. So, like, he hadn't made it known, I want a job and my son could be tied to it. But, like, if he did make it known, like, if Washington didn't do it, somebody else was going to do it. So, like, why not? Again, it's illegal. I think anything that is technically legal is fine, particularly in a sport where a lot of people don't think folks are operating inside the rule book anyway. To get players, high-level players, anything within the rule book is fine by me. I'll never be the columnist that questions that type of behavior. So if you got to hire Michael Porter Sr. to ensure you get Michael Porter Jr., I say do it. If you got to hire Devin Downey Sr. to get Devin Downey Jr., I say do that. Shout out to Devin Downey.
Yeah, that's right, baby. Absolutely. Real quick before we wrap it up, let's just quickly touch on something that my Twitter mentions have been flaming up on. So I killed Duke last week. Didn't really kill Kentucky, but I went after him a little bit as well this week. Listen, it's slow. It's July. We're in between recruiting trips, and they're releasing their non-conference schedules. Talked about this on the podcast with Sam before as well. My stance on this will remain firm and unchanged until something changes, and I just don't expect it to change soon. But doesn't mean I'm going to change my opinion on it. The schedules overall, non-conference wise, for both these schools, they're not terrible. They're not even bad. Kentucky has plenty of big names schools on the schedule. It will play home against Kansas. It will get North Carolina on a neutral in the CBS Sports Classic. It gets Michigan. I'll be there for that game in New York for the Champions Classic, which happens obviously the first Tuesday of the season. It'll play Arizona State actually in a one-off in the Bahamas, the same spot where the Battle for Atlantis happens. They're going to play Arizona State, but it's not going to be in the Battle for Atlantis. My point is, college basketball, and you've harped on this as well, so we don't have to spend too much time on it, but it is timely. I figure we should hit on it real quick. The sport's not better served by having its top 10, top 15 programs simply refuse to play games on the road. Don't get me wrong. I understand why Mike Krzyzewski, John Calipari, and a lot of coaches refuse to do so. Kentucky's only road game is against Louisville this year. Of course, last year they went on the road. They played Kansas in the Big 12 SEC Challenge, so they get the return of home, and they did play UCLA on the road last year as well. To me, when you're citing examples of major conference top 15 teams going on the road to play twice in a non-conference situation, to me, that's just not good enough. I understand it's the state of the game, but I think we should be pushing programs and coaches to simply do better and try harder. And in a perfect world for me, I'd have the NCAA mandate that every team in college basketball plays at least two true road games in order to qualify for the NCAA tournament. That won't happen, but the sport would certainly be better for it. There's one more thing I want to throw in here. There is a practical element to this in that a lot of these programs have to have a certain number of home games in order to raise money. So I understand that's also a big part of it. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Texas and Michigan have just agreed. Rothstein just tweeted as we were recording this podcast. They're going to do a home and home. There have been, I feel like there's been a little bit of a flurry of more of these coming. I've written on a few of them this offseason. There simply should be as many of these as possible because college basketball at its best, sure, you can say the NCAA tournament, but I'm telling you, two top 20 teams playing in one of those teams' home gyms, no matter what time of the year, I'm telling you that's the best of the sport.
It's terrific.
And it needs as much of that as possible. So we shouldn't necessarily let these huge programs skate on playing three or four other top 30 programs, but all of them being on neutral court environments. That's simply not good enough for me.
I agree. And yet, you know, as I wrote late last week, you know, whether you're talking about Duke's schedule or Kentucky's schedule or basically any, you know, high major schedule, you know, they're all going to look similar in this way. Too many games that are completely uninteresting and are basically mismatches. But the reason that's the case is it's a college basketball problem. It's not a Duke problem. It's not a Coach K problem. It's not a Kentucky problem. It's not a John Calipari problem. It's a college basketball problem. There's no incentive, no real incentive for those types of schools to challenge themselves consistently in the non-league and or go on the road. I would love the suggestion you made to actually be real, that the NCAA said, hey, in your non-league, you got to play two true road games to qualify for the NCAA tournament. We don't care where, but you got to go play them. That'd be terrific. And I don't even care if somebody would try to manipulate that system in saying, okay, well, we'll just play two road games at, you know, hey, we're Duke, we'll go play at North Carolina Central. Fine. Go play at North Carolina Central. Wouldn't that be, but it'd still be awesome to have Duke at North Carolina.
Really cool.
Go play at North Carolina Central. That would be awesome for North Carolina Central. So I'm fine with it. I'd prefer Duke to go play at Indiana or Duke to go play at Kansas. But if somebody tried to say, okay, you can make us go on the road, but you can't make us go challenge ourselves on a road, we'll go play a low major on the road. Awesome. Go play a low major on the road. It'll make for a great scene. It'll make for memories for those people on that campus forever. I'm fine with that. But you know, it's just, you're also right. That's not going to happen. And among the reasons it won't happen is because there is a financial aspect to this. I don't mean to bring up Memphis again, but I'm very familiar with that program because I covered it. And even if Josh Pastner or John Calipari or now Tubby Smith wanted to go really challenge themselves in the non-league and go on the road and play Wichita and go on the road and play Gonzaga and go on the road and play Indiana, they could only do so many of those games because they have to have a certain number of home games. And here's why. They play in an 18,000-seat arena. They sell, not anymore, but at one point they were selling about 16,000, 17,000 season tickets. Every one of those games, that's why they play so many bye games. They pay somebody $65,000 to come in, but they'd make so much more than that. And at a school like Memphis that's non-Power 5, that had to, where basketball had to support the football program, like the basketball revenue helped pay for football, it was just like your hands are tied. You have to have so many home games against bad opposition because that's how you create the season ticket package that's going to produce the largest amount of revenue you could possibly produce. So I'm not always critical of coaches in these situations because I understand that a lot of times it ain't up to them. You know, their athletic directors or presidents or chancellors are saying, we don't care what you do with these three games, but these nine have to be at home. And they can't be home and homes because we can't afford for you to go on the road next year. We need that home game again next season. So you got to play these low majors and buy games, even if you're going to be favored by 20 every single time. Because we need a certain amount of games in this building to help fund our athletic department. So it's a flaw within the system. And while I do think it's improvable, I don't know that it's completely fixable. But it is undeniably one of the issues with college basketball because, and I've thought this for a while, like if you're a North Carolina fan or you're a Kentucky fan or you're a Indiana fan, outside of just I love going to the games, why would you pay for season tickets? Like a good portion of a great college basketball team's games are going to be total mismatches. And it's something, frankly, you just don't get in the NBA. Like you know, in the NBA, like half your games by definition are against playoff teams. Now that doesn't mean like they're all great playoff teams, but like you consistently, if you're an NBA season ticket holder, you consistently get competitive games. In unless you're a Lakers fan lately, and a Sixers fan, obviously. But, like, for the most part, you know, like, I'll just stay in Memphis. If you're a Grizzlies fan, you buy season tickets, you know, a good portion of the games are going to be competitive basketball games. In college basketball, if you're a fan of a really good team, a good percentage of the games are not going to be competitive. A good percentage of the games are not going to be interesting, and yet you're still paying same price for that. It's always, like, I'm glad people do it, but I don't know why they do.
Yeah, I know. I still think this can be fixed. I think if there are more, not totally fixed, but I still feel like if more top 30 program level programs in college basketball agreed to home and homes, I'm not saying a major. I'm not saying that Kentucky and Texas and Duke and Kansas and all these programs have to absolutely load up with insane schedules. I'm saying if you swap out even two games that are kind of just meh throwaways, whatever, and you replace them with home and homes against like programs, even just two, it would significantly upgrade the appeal of your schedule and upgrade the appeal of college basketball at a time when it's never going to beat football, pro and college, in November. But even, you know, into late November, into December, when their college football slows, I still think that there's a lot of room for improvement there. I think we'll eventually get there to a certain extent, just because I can't see college basketball overall settling for this over a long period, because it would damage the sport too much. That's my personal opinion. I could be wrong, but it's not totally fixable, but it's definitely something that's improvable. And that's why it's worth making some noise about it now, because then when we get to November and we see the schedule and people are just like, oh, what's going on here? Well, you know, that's why you need to kind of keep these schools on the hook for this kind of stuff, so that it's at least a part of the conversation going forward, even though there are obviously financial hurdles that must be cleared, and it's something that can't be totally eliminated unless you went down to like 120 teams in D1, which would probably benefit college hoops, but that's also never going to happen.
No, so. You'll have I would love that too, downsized Division 1, because there's too many teams in Division 1. But to your point, we'll have weekends in November, December, where there's like one game between top 25 teams. Sometimes I believe zero games between top 25 games, and that's just not fun for anybody. So I'm not sure that it's going to get fixed, but I hope you're right. I know it is improvable, and I'd like to see it improve. Remember, you can subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast on iTunes. That's the best way to get the latest episodes as quickly as possible. So please do that. Thank you all so much for listening. We're going to talk to you again later on this week, I think, from Las Vegas. So make sure to check that out. Until then,
no promises, though. Let's just see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes. I bet we could fit in 30 minutes in Las Vegas, right, Norlanda?
I think so, but you just never know. That's all.
In fairness, you never know. Perhaps we'll talk to you from Las Vegas. If not, I promise we'll talk to you next week. Either way, till then, take care.